Crossing to London now to speak to Pete Ross from the BBC World Service. Good morning as it is there, Pete.
Good morning indeed, Karen. Hello.
Pete, what advice can we expect from the World Health Organization today, and with infection rates spiking across Europe, what's the latest there?
Well, Karen, before we get to what we might expect to hear from the WHO this morning, just to go on to that word spike there, because I've had to get my thesaurus out this morning to look for a new word to describe what's going on across Europe this weekend. Obviously, different numbers for different areas. What could seem big in one place would be quite small somewhere else. But in France, for example, 26,000 infections in a single day at the beginning of the weekend. That's their greatest single day increase since the beginning of all of this. And then the Czech Republic, which was seen early on in the pandemic is a bit of a success story in how it was handling things. That situation there now deteriorating quite badly. They've had over 8,000 cases in a single day, and now that's the fastest growth rate per capita in Europe. Somewhere else where the growth rate is spurting or going up very quickly is, of course, here in the UK, and our Prime Minister Boris Johnson, he's expected to announce a whole set of new measures later on today. He's chairing a special COBRA meeting, an emergency meeting to discuss how to deal with things as well. But certainly numbers going up very rapidly right across Europe and concern here in the UK for sure.
How are the hospitals coping, Pete? Are they as overwhelmed as they were, say 6 months ago?
Not yet, but that's certainly what we're beginning to hear, that the direction in travel is certainly that. Nothing yet, hard on that. But I think there's a lot of confusion as well, Karen, really, to be honest. The general public see these huge, as I said at the top, figures can be confusing. And we're seeing huge numbers, much bigger than we did in March. But of course, lots more testings going on. There's also just confusion over the rules. As I think, our government and many governments, certainly around Europe, are doing their absolute best not to go into a full national lockdown. So they're trying to do local measures. If you go to somewhere like Madrid, last week the top court in Spain actually, went against the government to say that tight, very tight restrictions they wanted to introduce into Madrid, that was actually going to convene some human rights, so they weren't able to do that. And certainly here in the UK, confusion over these rules, confusion over what areas are in tight restrictions and what aren't. And if I can just give you one example, there's a big football game in Scotland last week. We had our first penalty shootout. We've only had two in our entire existence. And that penalty shootout went on past 10 o'clock. So you see these pictures of, people in pubs watching the game. The game goes beyond 10 o'clock. The pub closes. So huge crowds pour out onto the streets. They all fish their phones out of their pocket and gather around phones to watch the game. So a lot of people, particularly in the hospitality industry, questioning some of the rules and why they're there and what the scientific evidence for it is.
That would have been a crazy moment. A lot of very unhappy people.
Absolutely.
All right, let's go now to Thailand and Bangkok. And there are more anti-government protests challenging the institution of Thailand's traditional ruling class, and including this criticism of the monarchy, which hasn't been seen before, and another protest expected to take place in Bangkok this week.
Yes, absolutely. As you say, unprecedented waves of protests sweeping across Thailand in recent months. There's a long history in the country of political unrest and then protest to counter that, stretching as far back as the 1970s, big student protests then and even further. This year in February, a court ordered a fledgling pro-democracy opposition party to dissolve. And that's where we saw the beginnings of protests this year. Since then, we've seen a series of political scandals, and I guess you could fold in the unfolding COVID crisis as well, the economic disruption caused by that. And so the protests have been growing in number against the government and sympathy growing for those student protests. Now, that's on the anti-government side. And they've got a number of demands. As I said, they want this government and the prime minister, who's a former army chief and seized power in that coup, you'll remember, back in 2014. They want him gone. They want the government dissolved. They'd like the constitution rewritten. And they want the authorities to stop harassing critics. Now, there's a lot of public sympathy for this. But as I said, and you've mentioned it yourself, the other branch of this is the criticism, and it goes against long-standing taboos of criticising the monarchy. Now, Karen, I imagine that Thailand's a pretty popular destination for many New Zealanders or for holiday, as it is with Brits over here. And if you've ever been to Thailand, you'll know one of the very first things you learn when you get off the plane or when you first arrive, do not criticize the monarchy. You know, they've got very strict laws and you can go to prison for up to 15 years. So the fact that these young people, these students are getting together and saying, look, we want something to be done. We want the country's monarch's powers to be curbed. That really is a very big deal indeed. And there's two things to look out for just quickly this week. One, the monarch himself is returning from Germany. He actually lives there and runs the country from Germany, something he was criticized for by members of the German government only last week. He comes back because it's the anniversary of the death of his father this week. And then also October 14th, on Wednesday, it's the anniversary of the October 14 uprising. That's a student protest from 1973 that sort of led to the end of the ruling military dictatorship at that time and altered the political landscape. And as I said, led to this kind of tradition of protest. So two very big dates in the calendar to watch out for this week. We could see many people on the streets protesting in Thailand.
And today, a vote's taking place in Israel's parliament, and that's to ratify last month's historic peace deal between Israel and the United Arab Emirates. It's another step towards establishing a full diplomatic and economic tie between the two. What does this deal mean for the region?
Well, it's a pretty big deal as well. And this deal was actually signed in the White House last month. Israeli officials at the time saying, look, this is significant, not just because of the billions of dollars of trade it could generate with United Arab Emirates, but also it's about the change in the balance and power in the region. Now, as I said, the US have had a big hand in this deal. The deal was signed in the White House and President Trump made a big thing of it. He saw it as a real big political victory. You'll, of course, remember that when he entered the White House 4 years ago now, he said he wanted to bring about peace in the Middle East. Now, it's a catchy phrase, but I think it's fair to say he's failed to deliver on that promise. However, normalization of ties between Israel and Arab nations is a big deal. And at that time last month, White House officials said that not only the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain who'd signed on at that time, but they were hoping other countries in the region were also going to start moving towards normalizing ties. I think they mentioned Oman, Sudan, and Morocco. However, the big prize would be Saudi Arabia. And this weekend, we got our first indications, or perhaps our clearest sign yet, that Saudi leadership may be preparing for an eventual deal with Israel. A guy called Prince Bandar bin Sultan Al Saud, he's a longtime ambassador to Washington, 22 years in the post, and he spent the weekend, it seems, on Saudi television criticizing the Palestinian leaders and their efforts to find peace. And that really is quite a change in language. And it's just to remember as well, there's no way this guy would be on television in Saudi if it wasn't already approved by King Salman and the Crown Prince. So, you know, as I say, a real indication that perhaps a deal with Israel and Saudi is somewhere down the line, is coming somewhere down the line. And that really would be a very big deal indeed.
And just finally and quickly, Pete, this missile in North Korea, what do we know about this missile that was on parade?
Well, not a lot, except for the fact that it's very, very big, which seems quite simple. But I mean, it really is the main thing here. There was a 75th anniversary of North Korea's Workers' Ruling Party. So a huge celebration. Leader Kim Jong-il gave quite an emotional, it's been described by local media reports, speech at the beginning. But the thing that really jumped out for most people watching the region was these pictures of this huge missile, colossal in size and description. You know, you'll have seen the pictures on the television, even though this was the 75th anniversary, you know, the military parades. This time the missile much bigger in size, essentially suggesting that the US is very worried about the nuclear capabilities and how that's been developing in North Korea in recent years. And the size of this missile would suggest that now that North Korea has taken another step to being able to reach all parts of the US. And of course, that, again, would be of serious concern for Washington if that's the case.
Pete, thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Thanks very much for having me.
That's Pete Ross from the BBC.